Welcome to The Limits. I'm Jay Williams. We are in replay mode this week on my show, so I'm bringing back one of my all-time favorites, the one and only Ben Baller. I mean, he was a former hip-hop executive and Dr. Dre protege who heard Jay-Z's first demo and thought Jay-Z actually wasn't a star, believe that. He's now a drawer to the legends, past and the present, including everybody from Mariah Carey to even Michael Jackson. And he's also a dad who, like me, strives to be present for his kids each and every day. We'll be back with new episodes soon, but for now, here's my man, Ben Baller. Welcome to The Limits. I'm Jay Williams. I know a thing or two about reinvention. That moment when your plan comes to a screeching halt and bam, everything changes and you're faced with the decision. Do I stay stuck or do I change along with it? My guest today wrote that blueprint. Ben Baller has reinvented himself not once, not twice, not three times. He's done it four times. When Ben hits a dead end, he doesn't just turn around. He gets out of his red Ferrari, puts it up for sale, and keeps it moving. What hasn't been done? He's played football, basketball, worked on films in Hollywood. He's been a hip-hop DJ, worked with Jay-Z, Dr. Dre, and Missy Elliott. And when that didn't work out, so what? He became a jewelry artist for the gods. You know him as the person who has iced up the industry's legends. He's made custom diamond pieces for everyone in the game, including Tyler, the Creator, Lil Uzi Vert, Drake, even the legend himself, Michael Jackson. In 2021, Kid Cudi walked the Met Gala red carpet wearing one of Ben's most ambitious pieces yet, a diamond-encrusted cause-inspired astronaut on a diamond-encrusted chain. It was worth over $1 million. Now, Ben's an icon. Long story short, a lot of times things didn't work out for him. But when the gamble didn't pay off, reinvention sure as hell did. Here's my conversation with Ben Baller. What's up, big boy?
Yo, what's good, my boy? What's up, Jay?
Man, I'm tired. I had a long day, you know, getting up every day at 2:45 in the morning. But I got to tell you something that's crazy. I was listening to a podcast that you and your sister did a while ago. And first off, I didn't know you come from a family of bosses like this. I mean, watching the dynamics between you and her relationship, it's crazy. But you guys start talking about hustle. And you're like, yo, look, if we don't have it, we'll find a way to get it done. So I guess coming into this pod, I got really no excuse about being tired. This is all part of the hustle, right?
I mean, bro, it's really crazy. I think about, I've never done a podcast with my sister before, right? You know, she was the middle child. She was treated like a middle child. But my mom is the one who taught me how to be a hustler. My mom, strong woman, came here with 20 bucks. You know, like she had really just a life like, if my odds were to go, okay, let me go back to, you know, not when she was born, but let me just go back to like 1964 and then her coming to America. And then let me think of like, you know, I don't know, a rough time, either pick Detroit, East St. Louis, Compton or something and being in the hood. Like it just, I'll take their life before I take my mom's life. You know, she had her struggle was crazy. So when I think about her, 118 hour weeks, sewing dresses, true story. No, not even exaggeration in any bit. My mom was robbed last week. She's 80-year-old old Korean woman robbed by five dudes and she's still resilient. My mom's like, you know, whatever, it is what it is. And you know, just like Nipsey said, the marathon, you know, must continue, right? It goes on.
So, wow. I first and foremost hope your mom is okay, but I wanted to dig into something that your mom taught you about hustle because man, you've hustled for such a long damn time. You went from a college athlete to working in Hollywood as a record producer. So tell me, how does a Korean kid from nowhere end up working with Dr. Dre in LA? How did that even go down?
To tell you the truth, I was a nobody. I was being a PA. I got a degree in cinematography, but I'm trying to be an assistant. Just trying to do whatever I can to get into business. There's a funny movie called A Night at the Roxbury.
Of course.
It's based on the world famous Roxbury nightclub. I mean, there's a little bit of truth to it. The crazy guy that Chaz Palminteri that was playing, that guy's name is Ely Samaha in real life. I became friends with him. Somehow he liked me. His wife was Tia Carrera. I ended up being her personal assistant. I told him I DJ. He's Lebanese and like speaks in Arabic, would cuss at me. Like anything I did, he's like, yeah, shut up. Shut up, Chinese boy. You don't know what you're talking about. And to tell you the truth, I never took offense by it. This was a different time and, you know, during that time. One day, the DJ at the Roxbury does not show up. No joke. He was smoking crack. I happened to live 5 minutes from the nightclub. And I had my record. I said, Ellie, please. I beg you. I promise you I'm going to be okay. I go DJ. I end up being the alternate DJ after that. On Thursday nights, a hot night. Like, you know, you got everyone from the Wayans brothers to Sylvester Stallone to all these celebrities. Yeah. And I end up trying to figure out where I can get more gigs. So my boy, who his dad's like my godfather, he's one of the people I almost tried to buy the Lakers back in the day. He said, hey, I'm partners on a restaurant. I'm a small partner. I could just only tell you this. Norm Nixon, Debbie Allen, this guy named Brad Johnson, who's a very, very famous black socialite, and Denzel Washington owned this new spot. I have a small piece of it. Me and Jack Nicholson are coming in as partners. If you want, you can try to see if you can get a job there as a DJ, blah, blah, whatever. So I'm outside every day while they're making this restaurant. And there's a Spike Lee's, he has a place called 40 Acres and a Mule. And he has this little, Spike Lee has this little merch shop across the street. So I'm outside waiting, just trying to see, hopefully one day I see Denzel, or if I see Debbie Allen, or see Norm Nixon, whatever. I hit the trifecta. I meet Denzel, we chatted up, boom. I wouldn't leave him alone. I know he likes hip hop.
Wait, just walk straight up to Denzel Washington on the street?
100%. Has his Porsche outside. I was like, yo, I walk right up to him. I was like, hey, man, look, hey, check it out. I heard you got a restaurant. I'm trying to, you know, he's like, what the hell are you talking about? Like, he thought I was trying to audition for a movie or something, you know, and he just finished Malcolm X. So, you know, this dude's like the biggest actor in the world. So, gives me a chance. A girl calls me. I end up getting a job. It wasn't even an audition. I end up getting the job. Working at this one place called Creek Alley, one of the most legendary Jamaican restaurant, bar, nightclub, upscale. I met everyone you could think of there. Tupac, Dre, everyone. I DJed the Black Oscar party 2 years in a row. I DJed the Black Grammy party 2 years in a row. Met Quincy Jones, met all these people, and they loved me.
Wow.
One night, me and Dr. Dre chopped it up. He with my vibe so heavy, he gave, you know, I gave him my pager number. He paged me. I started going to Death Row Records, boom, here and there. He ended up helping me get a job at Priority Records. Priority's how I kind of slowly, not necessarily because this is way before Rich Kleiman and me met, but like, you know, this album came on my desk, and I'm now vice president of A&R there. And it was Jay-Z's first album, Reasonable Doubt. Had not been signed. No one heard of it. And so we signed Jay-Z.
Well, what did you think about it when you first heard it?
I thought it was amazing. The only thing was, I didn't think that Jay was a star. And I told him this at the 25th anniversary of Reasonable Doubt, that Jay and Biggs asked me to be the host. Like, yo, you were the A&R. You got to be the host of the thing for LA. So,
just hearing you say I didn't think Jay-Z was going to be a star, that's wild.
Ready for this? I said it, and Biggs admitted too, because me and Biggs are boys. By the way, you always remind me of Biggs because you guys look similar.
Why does everybody always say that? People have stopped me on the street and be like, yo, Biggs. I'm like, yo, I'm not Biggs, bro. I'm Jay Williams. Yo, do we look that much alike?
Y'all look similar, man. Go lie.
I gotta meet him.
So Biggs tells me, he's like, yo, I didn't think so either. I pulled Jay to the side. I'm like, yo, my guy, I don't mean to say this to be biased, because this is the only record on Priority. This was my favorite album, fam, on God, on everything. He's like, yo, me too, real talk. So, like, Reasonable Doubt was like, you know, that was like one of my big things. But, you know, I worked on Friday, the movie. We did a lot of stuff, yeah. Master P stuff. But I just signed a max contract as an A&R. You know, you have contracts there, employment contracts. You have an attorney, yep. Boom. I just signed a max contract. My attorney's name is Peter Paterno. He's still Dr. Dre's attorney to this day. And my boss, Brian Turner, if you watch the NWA movie, it's a real story. Brian Turner's like, yo, we're about to do some big things. I have a girls' R&B project. I'm trying to work with Tupac. I have Faith Evans developing this group. I'm working with Missy Elliott. Missy Elliott's not even signed yet. Missy is not even signed at all yet. And I saw the vision of Missy. Missy ended up being iconic, right? Dr. Dre hits me up. He goes, yo, I'm about to start Black Market Records. That was the name he had. He couldn't get it. He said, "I, you know how I get down. Yes or no? Ain't no let me think about it, blah, blah, whatever." And I'm sitting like, yo, I got an office in the corner. I got an assistant. I got a budget. I have an expense account. I have all this stuff. I have everything I've ever wanted. And I'm like, I'm coming with you, Dre. That's it. How do I tell my boss? And so I tell him. Anyways, yeah, you know, end up going to Dre to Aftermath. And, you know, that was where I ended my music career. And I don't think we bumped heads a lot.
I was going to ask you, Ben, why did that end, right? Because obviously you went on from there. You've done a lot more incredible things. But it seems like that trajectory had you on a different stratosphere. Like, what made that come to a stop?
It's a good question.
Thank you. I do this for a living.
The business side was so shady that I hated seeing these dudes from the hood, whether it be South Central, Compton, Detroit, wherever, Pittsburgh. Their attorneys were letting them sign deals that were signing their likeliness, their namesake, their publishing, and everything away. So meanwhile, you know, I'm pulling off in a Lexus, BMW, SUV, I got a Rolex, whatever. These dudes have sold some albums, but they don't own any of their masters. They don't own any publishing. They don't own nothing. And that was common. That was common trade, you know. And that was when we were selling music. So like people were making some money back then, real money, you know, Diddy and everybody. So at a certain point, I couldn't see my homies put their checks into jewelry, cars, and have no investment in anything else, not trying to get the publishing or anything. And it wasn't until now, think about it, this is 25, you know, years later, that people are understanding the power of owning your own masters, owning, you know, or getting a publishing deal. Mm-hmm. And perfect example was when I finally left, true story, I've actually never talked about this before, Hitman from my high school, from Fairfax, from high school, he wrote almost 70% of one of the highest selling hip-hop albums ever in history, Dr. Dre 2001. He was on the album on almost every song. Hitman is the only person on that album that has a solo song. He's the only one, act right. When he wrote Explosive, West Coast shit, my brother said, and that's Hitman, right? He signed such a bad publishing deal that to this day, Hitman works like a regular 9-to-5. Like, had he signed even a decent publishing deal, like a decent one, just get some points, I don't think he could live a decent lifestyle and never work ever again in his life. You know, he would have made at least, maybe $13, $14, $15 million, but like, you know, he signed a really bad deal. I don't mean to put anything bad against Dre or anything. It was a business, but like, I was like, yo, man, like, how are you letting these dudes like not eat? Like, it's not like you can't still get rich and they can still eat. Like, I may eat. I mean, like, I'm talking everyone eat Wagyu. You know, it's not right. So it just put such a bad taste in my mouth, real talk, Jay, that I didn't want to be in music anymore.
Ben, how did you even, or did you try to talk to Dre about that, right? Because that's one of the challenges I always see, especially when you deal with people of power that put you on, right? And you could tell there's sensitivities to all these relationships because everybody comes from different places and they deal with conflict differently. So did you address him about it? Or was it something where you just kind of bowed down and said, you know what, I'm done?
So ready for this? And I don't want this to sound, I don't want this to be clickbait or nothing like that.
No, I just want to hear the realness from you.
He knew I was going to come with that, right? And I started being loud, and I've always been a loud person. And he fired me. So he let me go. That was it. I couldn't even get a hold of him. And I was like my studio card was revoked the whole night. Like, you see Jamal Adams trying to get back into the Jets thing. I was like, doo, doo, doo. The hell's going on here? And I was like, yo, this is crazy. And I was mad at him for a while. You know, I hated it, whatever. I was pissed here and there, whatever. And I was like, yo, man, like, look, I'm going to figure something out. I'm resilient. I'm going to pivot and do something. So thank God, you know, I was smart and I collected sneakers on a serious level. And I ended up figuring it out. You know, eventually it led me to jewelry, which was cool.
Okay, look, I know what you're thinking. What the hell does selling sneakers have to do with designing million-dollar necklaces? I keep trying to tell you, Ben Baller is a master of reinvention. After the break, Ben once again rolls the dice and lands a job designing for the Mariah Carey. And make sure you subscribe to NPR Plus for bonus content dropping this Thursday. In that episode, Ben gives easy-to-follow advice for getting into one of our biggest shared passions, cryptocurrency. This is The Limits from NPR. I'm Jay Williams.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Aspiration. To date, Aspiration has funded the planting of 50 million trees to offset climate change. And you can help, too, with Aspiration Zero, the credit card that plants a tree every time you swipe. Visit aspiration.com today to learn how you can make a big difference through small changes. The Aspiration Zero MasterCard is issued by Beneficial State Bank, member FDIC, pursuant to license by MasterCard International Incorporated.
All right, so Ben Baller obviously is balling out, gets let go by Dr. Dre, trying to find out what he wants to do next. Been hurt, you've been called the sneaker pimp because you were in the sneaker game before people even recognize what the sneaker game is. Now that's a multi-million dollar, billion dollar business,
billion.
Actually. Billion with the B,
yeah.
Multiple billions. And then you transition to jewelry. So tell me what the transition plan was into transitioning to jewelry. How did you optimize and monetize that?
So I started figuring out that my credit was bad. I couldn't buy a home then, even though that was the time when you could get a house with, you could say, oh, I make $17 million a year. No one's checking tax returns, nothing. It was a different time then, okay? I was able to finesse a condo.
Ben, what does finesse mean?
I was able to get a condo under my name, well, under a name, under a corporation, and just, you know, so it was like something to fall back on legally.
Okay.
And I had started like a small little exotic car rental business. It was completely not legal. It was like I was renting a car out that I, a couple cars I owned, and was like charging people. And people were like, yo, you want to use it for video? Cool. Boom. Here and there. Just to generate passive income. I was engaged to get married for the first time in my life. It didn't work out. I became like a video thought. I was in like a lot of music videos back in the day because I was kind of popular in LA and stuff. People knew when they came to LA to chat in with me. So I sold my sneaker collection on eBay in 2004, spring, for just under $2.9 million.
Wow.
When that money came, I officially became a millionaire, right? I had been broke three times before age 30. I was 31 at that time.
So what, you've been collecting shoes for that long that you sold that you got $2.9 million off eBay from it?
I was also doing a lot of marketing for Nike. So I was working with Nike for a lot of things. So I knew that I had shoes like just, I had a lot of shoes that were 10, 15, 20 Gs. But you got to remember too, Jay, I'm talking about like, you know, if you ever see what 100 pairs of shoes looks like, it's a lot, you know? Even when you get to the 500 mark, you start to realize, damn, that's a lot of shoes. I had 2,000 personal pairs of shoes. I had three full bedrooms completely covered, head to, you know, from ceiling to floor. So, you know, when I got rid of my shit, it was a big deal in the sneaker community. All through Nike Talk, it was the talk of the entire community. Complex, you name it. And that was just starting out. People all knew what time it was. That auction hit. I mean, it was as viral as it could be for the platforms that we had.
Wow.
At that point, I was always shrewd with money. I knew how to make money. I just wasn't really good with money. And one thing that Dre did tell me, he was the first person to ever say this to me. It was like a 96. He said, making $1 million is not that hard. Keeping it is harder than a month. You know what I'm saying? So I was like, whoa, it's crazy. Well, it was the first thing I did. The 30 minutes after the check cleared, I drove to Beverly Hills Ferrari. Got a Ferrari. Went back to my hood. Went to go see my people. Like, yo, you got to get one of these. Yo, I did it. Yo, fuck a whoop. I traveled and tried to find myself. I said, you know what? Before I do anything, I need to find who I am. I need to get some culture. I want to see how the other world lives. I went to Brazil. I went to Europe, all through Europe. I went to Asia. I just went everywhere with my passport. I said, man, look, man, I got 1,000 pair of sneakers. I ain't even been 1,000 miles away from home. Like, I've been to New York and stuff, but I'm talking about like really, you know, like,
yes,
check it out. So I did that. Came back and I'm thinking, look, I need to start some sort of business. Now, I don't want to just start a business like a coffee shop or like a restaurant or like a retail store. I need to start a business where my inventory is part of my net worth, or like, you know what I'm saying? Like my inventory is my, you know, thing. And my cousin was a jeweler. My uncle's a jeweler. He taught his son how to be a jeweler. And we just lightly discussed it. There's a lot that went in between that, but I'm just trying to keep it short. And so, you know, I ended up becoming a jeweler with no trade skills or anything. And I just like shiny things. A few years after things started getting big, like people started coming to me and I started making a lot of big jewelry pieces, I was like, I don't want to be a jewelry salesman anymore. You know, none of us have jewelry degrees, GIA degrees. have like 5 employees now who have GA degrees, but like I'll work circles around any person. Like, could you imagine, like, there might be someone like Kobe. He didn't go to college, right? But imagine like what he did in the game, right? He understood the game. Yeah. He just did. He didn't. So like, in a way, diamonds are the same. So, you know, I started taking classes. I couldn't believe that a local night school, LACC, which is like in a terrible neighborhood, like they had night classes for jewelry. So I started learning that. I started learning from my uncle. And, you know, sooner than later, I realized how much of a, you know, a person, how I'm a perfectionist. I have attention to detail, you know, and everything. So I started crafting pieces and I started realizing, look, the most important thing that I could have ever done was trademark Ben Baller and turn this into a global brand, right?
Did you do that right from the bat?
No.
Right from the start?
No. I had to get my accountant had set that all up later, and thank God I had the logos. I became, you know, people started seeing the logos and things. Look, could you have told me in even 2010, which was just, you know, earlier, you know, 11 years ago, that I'd be where I'm at now? No. I mean, one of the biggest parts of my success is all that time it took, all that time that Ben Baller gumbo was cooking in the pot at low heat, real low heat, just simmering and just braising and stewing up, right? To get to the point to where I signed with XL Sports Management and was the first non-pro athlete to, or non-athlete period to sign with the sports agency and them getting me multi-million dollar deals.
Ben, bring me back for 1 second when you were just hitting the jewelry game and obviously you started to trademark your name and you build out the entity. Do you remember your first big sale?
It's funny, man. My buddy was dating Mariah Carey and they were serious. And we were cool. Like we were cool enough to, I could ask like improper questions to dude. And I said, yo, I don't get really, the funny thing is we've been together 1,000 times. I didn't really get to really like, I mean, you know, she's an enormous star. It wasn't like she was around us all the time. You know, she's like, so like when he was able to be, you know, when she let him go outside, you know, I was like, bro, I don't mean to be this way to you, dog. But you gotta let me do a piece for her, bro, because I need exactly. I need that. And he goes, he was one of the few people I was like, it's done. Consider it done. And then she ended up wearing like in a Bone Thugs and Harmony video that she did, boom. And I don't think she probably was like, oh, this is cute. Probably threw it out, you know, whatever. It was like 40 grand. But that was like, you know, that was, but you know, like at the time when that happened, like I didn't think I made it at that point. And this was like, 05, 06, like in 2008, when I got introduced to Michael Jackson, my life had changed forever, you know?
Take me there. Tell me about it.
Oh, man. Michael Jackson's agent, his manager, this dude named Tome, gangster. Like, I can tell, I was like, yo, bro, this dude's the dudes that Liam Neeson is fighting and taking. Like, this the dude who killed people. like, this dude is, I already knew he killed 1,000 people. Like, this guy was scary. So we meet in this little coffee shop in Brentwood, California. I could not believe how openly public this place was.
So Michael Jackson pulls up to this random coffee shop that you're sitting in, open public space.
In a very nice neighborhood, though. This is a very, 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 very okay. upscale neighborhood.
But still, this is Michael Jackson we're talking about.
Trust me. I've dealt with the biggest celebrities in the world. Nothing will ever touch this, ever. I've been on tour with Drake. Come on. We sit down. We're not that far apart. This is probably maybe a 6-person circular table, maybe 5. I start asking questions. He doesn't talk to me. He talks to Tome, his agent. His agent talks to me. It gets even better. So I'm like, what? I was like, okay. And I'm just dealing with it because I'm the biggest Michael. Like, dude, I had the jacket. You know what I'm saying? Thriller. Come on, bro. Like, are you kidding me? Especially
sparkling
in my age.
Glove. You had it all.
Like, I idolize this dude, right? I end up making some pieces for him. He feels comfortable enough for me to go to his house. Go to his house, and we're chilling in the crib, and we're having a conversation. Could you imagine right now, I'm telling you a story. Jay, I'm talking to you. We're here. And all of a sudden, I just leave. He left the room. I'm sitting on the couch waiting for him. 45 minutes goes by. And I'm like, you know what, man? I know he's a little bit off, man, but like I need to figure this out. house was so goddamn big, I didn't even know where the front door was, okay? So I'm trying to figure out whatever, boom. I find his chef. His chef's like, oh shit, you scared me. He's like, who are you? Oh, I'm like, I'm Ben Baller, I'm a jeweler. I'm making MJ jewelry. And he goes, MJ's here? And I was like, I was about to ask you, do you know where he is? He goes, I haven't seen MJ in 2 weeks.
What?
And I'm like, what? What are you talking about? And he goes, yeah, man, you know, it's like, I just make food here and there and stuff. And I was like, all right, so you don't know if he's here. He's like, I don't think anybody's here. So he later checks on the cameras and everything, confirms, you know, nobody's here. The car's gone. And I was like, yeah, this fool just like in the middle of a conversation, like just left and left for like for good.
After the break, Ben reaches his limits. He refuses to accept his father's abuse. And he tells Kanye West that actually, no, he doesn't have time for Kanye's concert because he's too busy being the dad he never had. This is The Limits from NPR. I'm Jay Williams. This message comes from NPR sponsor Audible with the memoir, It Takes a Woman. Hollywood producer and author Devon Franklin explores the emotional journey behind the women who raised him. Listen to candid conversations on topics such as marriage, death, regret, and triumph. Devon invites you to learn the valuable lessons the women in his life share with him. Visit audible.com/ittakesawoman.
I'll kill somebody. That's why they call me the Korean Liam Neeson. I will.
I thought you were the Korean John Cusack. What happened to Liam Neeson now?
You see it? It says the Korean Liam Neeson and neon lights.
The Korean Liam Neeson, a.k.a. Ben Baller. We were talking about something very dear to us both, fatherhood. And Ben joked that he would indeed become the dad in that movie Taken. You know, the one where Liam Neeson's daughter gets kidnapped and he stops at nothing to save her life. It's interesting to me, though, because that's not how Ben's own dad treated him. We're going to talk about abuse for a few minutes, so if it's tough for you to hear, please skip ahead about 4 minutes. But I wanted to know how Ben went from an abusive relationship with his father to being the kind of dad that would give up everything for his own kids.
It's not an easy thing to talk about. In fact, you know, coming from a dad who was born in Pyongyang, you know, now it's North Korea, but it wasn't North Korea back then. And you think about my mom, the way she came up and how that was and how strict the household is. You know, typically, honestly, there's a stereotype that's true. Academics is extremely important. Like you could have three eyeballs. You could be the ugliest person in the world. If you got straight A's, if you were good in school, you know, you were looked at. If you were a scholar, you were looked at, you know. And I think that was beaten so down, so hard in my brother and my sister's life. My sister and brother went to boarding schools with the Kennedys and all these other people on scholarship. Me, you know, I got arrested 3 times before I turned a teenager. I was going in and out of jail. I was in trouble a lot, right? So, but I did have good grades and I did, like, I wasn't good while hunting, but I understood the work. And the reason why grades and things were bad for me was because my conduct was bad. I was always a class clown. I was listening to hip hop. I was like, whatever. There was no Asian American that I grew up with. First of all, I didn't grow up with Asian Americans really, but there was no other Asians that I knew when I go to church or something that were into the things that I were into. So my dad, being a professor at UCLA, you know, my dad was big on these things because my brother, he scored a 1580 on his SAT at 14 years of age. He missed one question.
Wait, I'm sorry, Ben. A 1580 at 14 years old?
Yeah, he missed one question and my dad put him in the hospital because he didn't get a perfect score. So my dad beat him to near death.
Wait. Rewind me back here.
Yeah.
Your brother at 14 scored a 1580.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you're being sarcastic or if you're being real with me. Your dad put him in the hospital? Like
my dad beat the absolute living shit out of him. That was the type of household we grew up in.
Wow.
Bro, you got to remember, man. For me to get a scholarship playing football, all I needed was an 800. So I went in there cold. I'll never forget. I went in there, it was like 7 in the morning, I took my first SAT score, like junior year, really late. I shouldn't have took it that late. And I got a 1060, right? Which wasn't bad.
Yeah, it's a good score.
My dad was like, man, you are an absolute f***ing disgrace to this family. You are literally like, you are dog f***. So, you know, education was a big deal. And when it started getting into college, you know, thank God for sports, because if it wasn't for sports, I wouldn't have gotten to school.
But wait, Ben, I don't mean to cut you off.
Yeah, go ahead.
But I just want to bring you back for 1 second, because it seems like, and this will be very challenging for any young individual to do, especially while they're in their formative stages of their life. When you're looking to say, hey, Dad, see me. I want to be seen, right? But at the same time, I feel like at a young age, you were strong enough to say, but this isn't me. Like, how did you balance that in a relationship, looking for that affection from your dad or your mom, and trying to find that through sports or other things to solidify yourself?
So here we go. 16 years of age, I'm at school, varsity football, varsity basketball. I'm crushing it. I'm all city. I'm all state. So I tell my dad, you know, this is what I want to do. So my dad whoops my ass. It's not a joke. And
you mean physical, like you guys physically fight?
Physically. I'm like, come on, I'm not grown, but I'm too big to get hit at this point, right? So I stand up to my dad. I say, listen, Pop, this is what I want to do. Like, I want to play ball. And he's like, you're not going to play ball. I was like, Pop, this is going to get me into school. And so I said what I said. I got kicked out of school. He whooped my ass even 10 times harder. And I tried to stand up for him. And at that point, my father, in so many words, said, I just can't deal with you anymore. Sort of disowned me. You know, by the way, just to mention this, I don't know but my dad and mom never went to one high school game, never one college game, not ever once.
Wow.
And I'm not trying to be sorry. It is what it is. You know,
it's just crazy to me, Ben, where you started with a father who was disappointed in you and taking it out on you. And look how far you've came. So I have to ask, where are you now in life, my man?
So where I am now, my boy Pomp, he's very big in the Bitcoin space, huge, Anthony Pompliano. He said something that tripped me out on, I don't know if he was talking to Gary Vee, he was talking to somebody, but he said when he was growing up, he used to look up to people who had money. And he idolized people with money. I was like, yeah, me too. And he said, now he idolizes people. He looks up to people who have time. And wow. Now I think about, like, whoa, that hit me a lot different because, you know, when I think about my friends who had kids at 32 or 33 or 34 or whatever, you know, in a way I'm jealous because, like, you know, I have my first kid at 39, right? I have my daughter at 44. It's like there's certain things that I want, you know, you know, I didn't take care of my body as well as I should have, right? I should have ate better and done certain things. So, look, legacy is a big thing for me. You know, I'm so busy. Even in the pandemic this year, I did, like, I think 80 flights. 2019, the year before the pandemic, I did 128 flights. You know, I jumped back and forth from here in San Francisco. I own 4 businesses. I have 117 employees. I got 3 kids, which are very demanding. And I have, you know, a wife. And I'm very active in, you know, our family's lives. And I think I'm just like, I went out enough for the rest of my life. I've seen everyone I needed to see. I just enjoy kind of staying home. I like going to a hotel and looking at the view and ordering room service. You know, I just like being around my family. So, you know, the goal is to make sure that everyone is good. You know, I ran into some old friends a week ago. And they had made their big money before I had. And they messed me up. They moved out of the Beverly Hills gated community and moved into a smaller chill area. And I was like, why? You sold 70 million records. And like, well, I'm not making music anymore. And I haven't made music in a while. And I'm like, okay, so what? And he goes, Ben, there's still property tax. There's still tuition. There's still this. And I was like, damn. You know, I didn't really think about that. You know, he just didn't want to have to worry about it later. And some people are like, oh, that's punk stuff. You should keep going. At a certain point though, you know, like, you keep going till you die, when are you going to enjoy your life? You know, I want to enjoy life with my kids. I want to have fun. I don't want to kill myself from working because we eat good. We're good. But, you know, the goal is to be with my kids in a way that my mom and dad never were with me. No disrespect to my mom because I love my mom to death, but I'm saying, like, I'm very present in their life. And it means everything to me. When everything is wrong in the world, I have my little daughter in the bed with me, which is going to sleep, or my son. I'll watch my kids sleep for an hour and just stare at them. And everything else is okay after that.
I got to tell you, Ben, though, you know, I recently started to see a therapist because I think I spent a lot of time when I first got hurt working on me, and then I lost myself into my job and my jobs. right? In order to kind of replenish what I felt like I lost as a player. And it's something my wife and I talk about all the time. And my therapist says something to me that I really struck me the other day, and you just kind of reconfirmed that. She said, you know, Jay, when you start putting your time into the things that are most precious and most valuable to you, then you will truly get rewarded. And hearing her say that and then looking at my daughter, and I know there are a lot of times when I'm sometimes maybe not present because my brain is spinning or an idea happens and I'm thinking about how I can execute the idea, or, hey, I have a connection. Here's the right opportunity for that connection, and I already have stock in this. Maybe I can monetize that connection. I've just missed 30 minutes of my daughter's life, right? Where she's talking right to me. So I think I appreciate you being vulnerable about that, because a lot of people struggle through that, man. And all these things that you've been able to accomplish, at the end of the day, when it's all said and done, we'll be able to leave something materialistic for them. But what we've given to them spiritually and mentally, that's
priceless. Look, I've had a lot of death in my life. I've had a lot of people that have passed. Unfortunately, you know, there's been so my two best friends in my adult life have happened. Now, crazy part where I didn't even think about this until I thought about what you just said right now. Since 1992, I've been a big motorcycle guy. I was in a bike gang. I was in a black bike club, riding bikes here and there. 2005, right on La Cienega in front of Lowry's, right down the street from my store, Beverly Center, I flipped my motorcycle 18 times, ended up at Cedar Sinai, boom, here and there. And I still rode like a son of a bitch. I rode in the rain. I was a hooligan, right? Because I hated myself. I was like, yo, man, take me out. Like, I didn't hate myself, but you know, who would ever do that, right? Like, why?
I get it.
And when I had my first kid, my wife said, you got to get rid of the bike. I was like, I can't. No. A baby was born. That bike was gone. Like, I just knew. I was like, look, I want to be here forever. I want to live to be 100 if I can. You know, I want to be around them. And sometimes, like, for instance, Thursday night, this concert with Drake and Kanye. And Kanye's like, yo, are you coming? I'm going to put you on this thing, blah, blah. And I thought about it. I was like, look, let me do a donation for the Larry Hoover thing, but I'm not going to make it. Like, you ain't going to make it. You know what's going to happen? But I was like, bro, I know your kids are going there and blah, blah. And I'm not here to tell you how to raise your kids. My kids are chilling. They're going to be asleep. They have a schedule, you know, this and that, whatever. Yeah. My daughter just learned how to play puzzles and stuff. And I was like, look, that concert's cool, but it can't mess with this puzzle with me and my daughter. And that's just where I'm at. That's what made me happy, you know?
Man, we are the words we speak to ourselves, my brother. And it seems like you're speaking some pretty powerful words to yourself on a constant basis. And I appreciate you sharing that with all the people listening to us today. And I appreciate you, man. I appreciate you taking the time, Ben.
Thank you for having me on the show, man.
So a big shout out to my boy Ben and his whole team for making this thing go down. We'll be back next week. Stay tuned. The Limits is produced by Karen Kinney, Mano Sundaresan, Lena Sunsgiri, Martin Gerwood, and Yolanda Sanguini. Music by Rum Team Eric Louie. Our executive producer is Anya Grumman. Special thanks to Charlotte Riggie.